Hi everyone, and welcome to this week Quantum Gravity Seminar. Today is a great pleasure to welcome Stefano Liberati from CISSA, and he will talk about analog gravity as a toy model of emergent space-time, three small lessons. As usual, if you want to ask a question, you can just raise your hand on Zoom, or you can ask anonymous questions using the Google form in the chat. And with this, Stefano, the stage is yours.
Okay, first of all, thanks to all of you to be here. I know that for you is an unusual hour. I mean, not too early, but so I've been told that this is an unusual time for the seminar. So thanks for coming. It's very, I mean, it's a pleasure, particularly for me, to talk for the group at PI and the people there at Waterloo. Because I mean, I have very fond memory of scientific discussions concerning some of the themes we will touch today that basically are at the, some of them were at the root of some investigation that I will present today. So I hope that in better times, there will be other occasion for other discussion. So let me start really from if, oops. Sorry, there seems to be a delay in the comments for some reason. Okay, so why, first of all, resorting to an analogy as the one of analog gravity? So analog gravity, as you most of you already know, is basically the simulation of gravitational phenomena through condensed matter systems, or in a broader sense, using ideas and scenarios that are inspired by the condensed matter system, basically to address gravitational phenomena. Of course, the dynamics in this case is not the gravitational one. We are not dealing directly with the Einstein field equation. But however, there are several aspects of general relativity, of gravity as we know it today, which are tantalizing, to say the least, in the sense that they show that somehow gravity has many strange features. One, the most common, well-known one is the thermodynamical aspects of black holes. But there are here a list of several things that we have been uncovering in recent years that seems to suggest that there is something radically different in gravity and in quantizing gravity than what we normally find when quantizing matter fields. One of these ideas that can be stimulated by this this kind of phenomenology is the idea of emergent space-time. Now, I think I want just to stress one point. I mean, you know, the idea of emergent space-time is basically that gravitons are not fundamental quantum particles. They're not really the equivalent of the photons. They are more similar in emergent space-time scenario to collective excitation of a more fundamental substratum. Now, normally, for people dealing with quantum gravity, hearing something like this raises a little bit of an eyebrows, because you start with the idea that, okay, I start quantizing basically from the equation from general relativity, how it can get end up with an emergent space-time scenario. So the first things I want to say is that when I mean emergent space-time scenario, first of all, I think it's not obvious that you're talking about something which is alternative to quantum gravity. It's not that there is quantum gravity and an alternative point of view is emergent gravity. I would rather say it in another way. Imagine that you have a quantum gravity approach where you have, after you quantize a discrete and quantum structure you are dealing with, for example, a spin network. Now you have to ask yourself, is this spin network, for example, I'm just taking the spin network as an example, a fundamental structure that has an ontological meaning. I mean, for example, you use it to count the degrees of freedom to count the entropy of the black hole, to have a microscopic origin of the entropy of the black hole. Or for you, it's a mere regulator that goes away. For example, more an approach like discrete in causal dynamical triangulation. Then, depending on how you answer this, I would say that you are in an emergent gravity scenario or not, because in a sense, then you have the problem to describe what is a gravitational wave, for example. What is a graviton in your approach? In a certain sense, you may face that you need basically to describe the limit toward continuous space-time and classical space-time in a language which is all the less, after all, not so different from what we normally we will see in quantum gravity, in analog gravity. So I will come back on this issue. So let me stop with basically the ideological ramble and start with the analog gravity and get into it. So analog gravity, for those of you which are less familiar with it, is a very simple, if you like, it is a very simple idea. It was realized by Urum in 1981, but in reality, he rediscovered something that surfaced in the literature all over the 20th century. And basically, it's a very simple fact. If you take an inviscid and rotational fluid, and you look at the continuity and Euler equation, and look at linearized perturbation over this fluid, you find that the linearized perturbation, for example, in the velocity potential, which is the scalar that you can introduce due to the fact that the fluid is irrotational, so the velocity is a gradient of a scalar, you can find that this perturbation in the velocity potential, yeah, psi, let's call it psi one, is described, the propagation, as a second order field equation, because basically you have two first order field equations, you put them together, you get the second order field equation. And this basically is a wave equation on a Hertz space-time. And the space-time that is describing this propagation is what is called an acoustic space-time. It's a very special form of space-time. It's not the most general metric you can write, but it's sufficiently general to describe most of the physical metrics that we like to play with, in particular black hole one. For example, if you take a Schwarzschild geometry, the Schwarzschild geometry, and you go to the so-called Paley-Wegusan coordinates, you can write that geometry exactly in this acoustic form, a modular conformal factor. You can do this also with the relativistic fluid. In that case, you find that the acoustic geometry is a disformal geometry, where basically you have G mu nu equal the flat space-time metric plus an Ablam, basically plus U mu, not properly normalized, where U is the four velocity of the relativistic fluid. Of course, these metrics are interesting because can be used to simulate black hole geometries. What you can do, and it's very intuitive that you can do that, because basically all you need to generate is a supersonic region at this point, right? And the supersonic region will basically be an entrapment region for your phono, if you can quantize the fluid, otherwise for your acoustic wave, and will basically reproduce the behavior of black holes. Actually, it's a nice analogy that you can even use at a pedagogical level to explain to someone how a black hole works. Once this idea basically was accepted, of course, you realize that there are many systems in which it can be developed. Basically, there are many analog systems nowadays that can be exploited, albeit, I would say that in particular, the one on which we deal mostly today, both the Einstein condensed state, became the most successful at the moment. Now, what you can do with analog gravity? Well, with analog gravity, normally what you can do, let's say analog gravity 1.0, the one that we've seen for many years now, is basically a model in which you have this emergent space-time from this fluid, and basically what you have is that if you are in the condition to be able to quantize this perturbation, you can basically study quantum field theory in Hertz space-time. You can reproduce whatever is a phenomenon in quantum field theory in Hertz space-time, like Hawking radiation or cosmological particle creation. And the only problem that you may have is that if you want to study back reaction, because there you have to deal with the shape of the equation, okay, of the field equation. So the models that have been studied are of two types. There are two simple models, two class of models. One is the classical analog models. A very common one is the one in which you look at gravity waves in a shallow basin. There, the speed of propagation, as you know, is the square root of the gravity acceleration times the height of the basin. And you have dispersion relation that you can see here. What people have done, you say, in these classical analogs, for example, what you can study? You can study the mode conversion, basically a kind of classical analog of the Hawking effect, because you can have a kind of stimulated emission. Or you can do super radiance, for example. Super radiance, if you have the analog of rotating the cogeometry, well, there is a nice point here. We cannot simulate with the acoustic geometry so far a curved geometry, because basically there is no known way to cast the curved geometry in the so-called Gordon form, which is a disformal geometry where the vector, where you can write it as eta mu nu plus u mu u nu, where u is a time-like vector. We know how to do it with an null vector, in that it's the Kerr-shaped form of the Kerr network. But anyway, you can simulate a rotating black hole geometry. You don't need to be exactly in Kerr. You have still an ergo region. You can do, for example, analog super radiance. This is, for example, it's been studied in an experiment in Nottingham by Skevaipur. Otherwise, you can have, but the same principle was used, for example, by Germain Rousseau initially to show mode conversion in a shallow basin. And so this is a very well developed analog gravity. Of course, this analog gravity model is only classical, so it's not suited completely to study, for example, what we normally call Oki radiation, the spontaneous emission from the vacuum. There are also quantum analogs and an alternative to the Bose-Einstein condensate, which I will spend most time in this talk, is, for example, optic fibers. In optic fibers, what you can do, you can send a pulse, which by the Kerr effect basically locally changes the refractive index. Then you can send also a probe pulse of light. And what is happening is that the change in the refractive index made in such a way that basically you cannot enter in the pulse from behind because your probe pulse is slowed down due to the increase in the refractive index. And at the same time, if you are inside the pulse, you cannot get outside. So the front wall is a black hole-like wall, and the back one is a white hole-like wall. Okay, and that you can use basically if there is spontaneous emission. So far, I think that it's fair to say that I've seen a kind of stimulated emission. And there was some discussion if you are actually seeing something more similar to cosmological particle creation because of time dependence. But let's say that still you can basically develop this as an analog model, and there is some margin for development in the future years. I think that is worth keeping an eye on. This is just a funny slide. I want just to make that these analog gravity are really fun also from a physicist's point of view, if you like to play with things. You know, sometimes, for example, a white hole horizon, they tell you that it's something that it's just because of time reversibility in the Einstein field equation. It's something like an unphysical solution. Although recently they had a kind of revival thanks to the possibility to resolve singularities in a bounce. But I just want to show you that basically you can do a white hole at home, analog black hole at home, and it's very relatively easy. So you look at your tap in your kitchen sink, basically put a dish, a flat dish after it, and try to have a very you know, a non-turbulent flow. And you surely have noticed that what generically you produce is a kind of ring around the column of water. This ring is basically the analog of a white hole because no perturbation can basically get in. And the reason why is that basically that is the ring where the outgoing velocity equals the gravity wave's velocity, which is, I remember, square root of GAH. And basically you can also show that there are the Mach cones in the sense that analog of the cones that you have when you have a sonic boom. And they are present only inside the supersonic flow region. You see here, you see the Mach cones. If you go toward the exterior, basically they disappear because the flux is no more supersonic. So if you go direct outside, you see that there is no Mach cone. So I just want to say analog gravity has something that sometimes is missed, which is the fact that you can play with the analogy and sometimes get analogy of something that even students may be difficult to cope with, and you can show them in a helpful sense in the analogies. So I find that this didactic aspect of analog gravity should not be neglected. So this, yes, Lee, I see your question.
Yes, great. Great to see you, Stefano. Is there one, it seems to me there's a property that distinguishes real phenomenon general relativity from many of these analogs. which is that the speed in the real world, the speed of gravity is always the speed of light. Whereas in the analogs, we tend to have several different speeds of propagation.
Yeah, this is a very good point. Okay, the analog gravity model that I've shown so far was a perfect fluid in Vichy linear rotation. And being perfect, basically didn't have a scale to break Lorentz symmetry. What you're saying is generically, there is a breakdown of Lorentz symmetry, which you can show in several ways. Or you have different form of perturbation traveling at different speed, or you have, most commonly in this, in the models that we are considering, a breakdown in the UV of the Lorentz, acoustic Lorentz invariance. This is, we will see, not a point of weakness for me of analog gravity, but a point of strength, independently of what you feel about the fate of Lorentz invariance in the UV. Because basically allows you to check the robustness of some of the phenomena in quantum field theory in curved space-time that are subject to the so-called Transplanckian issue, Transplanckian problem. And it was one of the main motivation of Bill Uru to look at this at the start, exactly because here you have a kind of under control UV deviation from standard physics. And at the time, Bill was quite worried about the Transplanckian problem. He would say, very often in his presentation, he said that the original Hawking calculation seemed to rely basically on the UV completion of the vacuum state, basically on Scry minus, in order to make an infrared prediction on Scry plus. So you want to understand if there is a robustness. So we will see how this Lorentz breaking is an aspect that makes in some sense some interest but it's totally correct. It is a different from the standard story of general relativity. Of course, if you, for example, are interested in the prediction of Orava gravity, it could be another story also, this the attitude with respect to UV Lorentz violation. But let me come to that. We will come back to this point in a few slides, okay?
Okay.
So let's consider now Bose-Einstein condensate. Now, Bose-Einstein condensate in recent years acquired a prominent role in analog gravity. I mean, I think one of the reasons, as we will see in a second, is that they provided the first experimental detection of analog Hawking radiation. So, of course, that made it. But they are also a very versatile system. And it's a system where you will see that there are a lot of ideas and lessons that can be drawn. So let me try to describe basically Bose-Einstein condensate. Normally, when we discuss Bose-Einstein condensate in a lab, we are talking about stuff that forms below 100 nanokelvin, is involving 10 to the 5, in the best cases, 10 to the 6 atoms. And basically what is happening is that the state, basically the quantum operator describing this bunch of atoms is satisfying a nonlinear Schrödinger equation, in limit in which you neglect higher order multi-particle interaction, which basically it has tantamount to say that the gases dilute. And what you normally do in order to treat this system is that you do a mean field approximation. So they split your quantum operator in a classical part, which is basically the classical wave function of the condensate, which is the expectation value on a ground state, plus an excited part, which is normally associated with the excited atoms or beta. This is not exactly an atomic operator. And in general, what you have is that your ground state, of course, is not the ground state of the atoms. I want to stress one point. This equation, we will see in a second. Let me go one step beyond before I make this other point. When you do the split, which is basically the Bogoliubov ansatz, so what you have, you get two equations, one for the background and one for the quantum excitation. And you notice that in general, in the background one, you have some back reaction terms. This is called anomalous mass and density, which are the expectation value of chi dagger chi and chi chi. And these are, if you like, the back reaction of the excited atoms on the condensate atoms, while you have an equation for the dynamics of the excitation. Normally, what people do is that it neglects this part, the quantum back reaction, and it's left with this part, which is purely classical. In this case, you could talk about the Gross-Pitaisky equation. Now, I want to stress one point. The Gross-Pitaisky equation is truly exact if and only if your ground state is a coherent state. It's a highly populated coherent state. In general, if you are in a situation where you have a number conserving situation, where you're not losing atoms in your trap, the state cannot be an equivalent state because that is not an eigenstate of the number operator. So it's always an approximation what you're doing there when you're working with a gross Pitagorean equation. But this, the first point I want to stress that the operator that will be associated with the quantum with the emergent space time, the one from the psi, this classical psi that is basically associated to the variables that then emerge the space time, is basically the expectation value, strictly speaking, of a quantum operator on a coherent state. That is the way you attain the classical space time. So you take this second equation, is the Bogoliubov degenerates equation, and you can do a Bogoliubov transformation, like this are called sometimes quantum acoustic representation. It's a generalization of the so-called Madelung representation. And what you do is a Bogoliubov transformation that basically goes from this quantum excitation to quasi-particle. And if you neglect this extra term that you would get in this equation for the analog of the velocity potential, you neglect this differential operator in first place, you get an equation which is basically, again, the equation that we saw for the perfect fluid, which is not surprising because basically to neglecting the quantum potential is equivalent to go back to a superfluid limit. And then the superfluid is in Vichy, the retrocessional and acoustic geometry theorem works. And in fact, you find an acoustic geometry as describing the propagation of the quasi-particle. In this limit, I would say exactly the phonons on the condensate. Okay. However, if you don't neglect that operator, you have an operator in your reflective geometry, which is not nice. You do an Econal approximation in order to replace that with something which is K-dependent. And what you get is a modified dispersion relation. This is exactly the UV Lorentz breaking I was talking about. It's exactly the same kind of dispersion relation that have been extensively studied in quantum gravity phenomenology, or that you get for gravitons when you're doing Gorava gravity, for example. In Gorava gravity, you have also k to the sixth, but the lowest order modification is the k to the fourth, given that the operator has CPT invariant. So in this case, what you have a theory basically where the effect that the space-time is emergent shows up in a UV violation of the Lorentz, acoustic Lorentz invariance. You see here, you have the speed of sound. You can show that the Lorentz group can be derived the standard way. Here you have the Lorentz principle of contraction, which is associated to acoustic physics, but it's nice to see how general special relativity can be recovered at low energy. And the nice part of this is that basically you have an infrared special relativistic dispersion relation and a propagation on a standard Riemannian spacetime, and in the UV you have deviation which are showing up basically in this modified dispersion relation. And if you want, it can be modeled by a momentum-dependent space-time, a rainbow space-time. Okay, so this is the situation. Now, I was saying that you can use at your advantage this discrepancy, say, with the standard picture, because this UV completion provides for you now a setting where you can analyze OK radiation having under control the UV completion. Now, in OK radiation, a very common basically, there are two big problems, as you know. One is the Trans-Planckian problem, and the other one is the information loss problem. The Trans-Planckian problem, I guess you're all familiar with it, is basically the simple fact that if you want to make a statement about the infrared physics on screen plus, you need to make a statement about the UV physics beyond the Planck frequency in the vacuum state that you're setting up in screen minus. If you want, this is also evident by the fact that if you trace back in time and look in quanta, you will find that these frequencies blue shifted rapidly. If you want to, of course, you can say this is not a Lorentz invariant statement, but of course, you cannot boost away an S wave. So the problem remains. And in fact, this problem, as I was saying, has been one of the main motivations, for example, in the early work by Bidur, Ruta, Jacobson, to look at analog gravity, understanding if there is a robustness of OK radiation in this respect. So in order to look at this, first of all, you need to simulate a black hole in Bose-Einstein condensate. You can do that in several ways. I'm showing you some of the model. One was a ring geometry where basically the atoms flow and they're here in a supersonic region where you have a black hole horizon and a white hole horizon. You can do that with the Raval nozzle, basically use or two Raval nozzle one after the other if you want to have something that goes back to subsonic after a while. Or you can do it the way it was done in the experiment, in a numerical experiment here on the right and in the real experiment on the left. The numerical experiment that was the first to show that there had to be OK radiation in this system was done basically with the fact that you can control the scattering length in a Bose-Einstein condensate by applying a magnetic field. There is an effect which is called the Feshbach resonance, which basically makes the scattering length change sign on the two sides of this resonance value. And what is happening is that in this way, you can, for example, increase, decrease the speed of sound downstream in a flow in such a way that this region becomes, even if the flow is always at the same constant speed, that this region, it is supersonic because the speed of sound is smaller on this side. The way it was actually done in the experiment with salt irradiation is different. What they do is that they accumulated Bose-Einstein condensate on one side, then they had a kind of waterfall. So you have a waterfall, and this waterfall is controlled with some experimental tricks based on lasers and so on, but basically you achieve a supersonic region, and then you flow away. And then you repeat the experiment lots of times. So how do you measure OK radiation? Well, you would expect basically thermal flux of phonons, but of course you cannot put a microphone in a Bose-Einstein condensate. So what do? You look at correlations. Basically, here you are in a situation in which you can see both sides of the horizon. So when you form an acoustic horizon, you have a way to predict basically what is the structure of the Hawking particle and partner correlators, which are shown here, which are basically dependent on density-density correlation. And then you can plot this correlation, actually 1 minus G2 here, and you can see what happens. Now, let me show you what happens in a simulation. What you see, okay, here the inside, the exterior of the horizon is a negative value of X. Zero is where the horizon is. And positive value of X are basically the interior of the black hole, is the supersonic region. So you have two effects. You see these moving out fringes. This is a dynamical Casimir effect because you generate dynamically the horizon. So you have a transient phenomenon, which is these fringes. This is basically the transient radiation. It's not really Hawking radiation. Then you have these two mustaches here. You see them? These two mustaches are exactly the correlation between particle which are, you see, positive and negative value of X and X prime respectively. And these are exactly the correlators between Hawking partners, between the two pairs of an Hawking pair. And this is basically the main signature of Hawking radiation. So when it was reproduced in a lab here, you see basically these two mustaches. Of course, they're harder to see. But most of all, in a recent Nature Physics, it was shown that the prediction, you see here these blue dots. These blue dots is the prediction of the analog gravity model, like with no Lorentz violation, just in the low energy regime, no? The relativistic model. And this is the temperature you would predict. The red dots are the measured temperature. And you see, there is this region here in which they agree very well. So what is happening? That you have, they form this horizon, you have a transient, a ramp-up period, then you have the formation of the outer horizon, and you have an Hawking radiation, which fits basically the prediction. This is set by the surface gravity calculated by the acoustic geometry. Then you form an inner horizon, and when you form an inner horizon, basically this spontaneous Hawking radiation ends for two reasons. One, because when you have an inner horizon, basically, you have two phenomena. One is that due to the modified dispersion relation at the inner horizon, you have basically a blue shift that forces you to access the UV part of the dispersion relation. So you have modes that are bouncing back toward the outer horizon and stimulating emission there. That is called basically the laser effect. And it was discovered by Ted Jacobson and Steve Corley in the 90s. And then you have another phenomenon. You have a Landau stability at the inner horizon that also generates modes directly. And so basically you have a region where now the distribution of the temperature goes away from the prediction of the standard analog gravity framework, so where you really mimic the standard black hole. But nonetheless, you have, for a sufficient long time, a very accurate reproduction because of the expectation from the Hawking calculation. Now, the normal answer, the first answer that you should ask yourself is how that is possible, given that I'm in a situation in which you have a UV Lorentz breaking. Well, the lesson is that in spite of having UV Lorentz breaking, if you have a separation of scales, the surface gravity of the black hole is very well separated by the scale of Lorentz breaking, then basically the Hawking radiation is robust. And not only, but also provided the Lorentz breaking for a cutoff at the horizon, by which you get automatically finite entanglement entropy and so on, and also give you a thickness of the horizon. You have really an embodiment of a stretched horizon in some sense. And again, the crucial issue, as usual, is the vacuum state at the horizon for observer which are falling, free-falling in the horizon. So it's very important also that you realize a vacuum state, but in a situation where you start with no phonon and you generate dynamically the horizon, this analog of the Uru state is automatically enforced in spite of this UV correction. So this is the first lesson, which is the robustness of Hawking radiation with respect to UV physics. And I want to stress, you may be skeptical and rightly so about UV Lorentz breaking, but this is not the point. The point is that it is showing you analog gravity, how this UV completion, even if Lorentz breaking, is not killing Hawking radiation, as it would do, for example, a brutal cutoff in the UV, okay? So it's quite interesting, and I think it's a remarkable lesson that we did require. But let me move to the other big issue with black hole, the information loss problem. Now, information loss problem, why you may have an information loss problem in analog gravity? You see, the information loss problem is a problem which is related to the fact that in order to basically describe the evolution of a quantum state on this hypersurface sigma one, and evolve it in whatever you find on the superface, sigma two after the evaporation. Basically, you cannot do it with a unitary operator. And this is related basically to the presence of singularity. It's not the case that, for example, people have tried to solve this problem by considering regular black hole. Now, on the other side, in an analog gravity setting, there cannot be any low information loss problem, right? There cannot be. Take a Bose-Einstein convex. It's a quantum system. Everything is concerned. Yes, Lee, you have a question.
Yes, more a comment. I don't think that space-time diagram is correct. I know that people have been drawing it since Steve Hawking, but I don't think it corresponds to any calculation that anybody's ever done.
But that I agree with you. But in fact, I'm saying, for me, for example, that is a problem. But you see, okay, let's discuss about this for a second. I totally agree with you, basically. I've done a lot of research basically saying that this diagram is the wrong story.
Yes.
And that is why you seem to have a problem.
Now, there are some,
because even in a regular black hole, you may have a problem if you're not careful. But it's probably one would dedicate it. But I totally agree with you, Lee. The problem I'm making to you is the following. In analog gravity, in principle, I can always generate an analog system where I do an analog black hole and I generate inside the analog black hole a non-hydrodynamic region, where basically I have to resort to an atomic description, basically to say what's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in principle, if I just insist in using the analogy and do semi-classical gravity, the way quantum field theory in curved space-time, more correctly, analog on the analog space-time, it seems I can have the same problem if I completely evaporate the black hole. Okay? And here, in a certain sense, I can do it by hand. I can really make the black hole disappear. Actually, we will see that in some black hole, the quantum back reaction works exactly as in the semi-classical case. It shrinks the black hole. I will quote a paper in a second that we did a recent calculation. So let me basically state the problem. The problem is that in analog gravity, in principle, you can reproduce the problem because in principle, you can reproduce a non-hydrodynamic region where basically your geometry is not valid. But basically you would have to trace out your Hawking partner. But on the other side, in a Bose-Einstein condensate, if you are in a number conserving formalism, there is no way you're going to have a violation of unitarity. This is a true quantum system. So the problem is how in analog gravity is resolved the unitary loss, this apparent, let's call it this, unitary loss problem. What is the resolution in analog gravity? In order to do this, it's clear that you have to take into account the atoms in the condensate. You want to not lose track of the fact that there is a part of your Hilbert space associated to atoms in the condensate. You cannot take the mean field approximation as usual. Fortunately, you can describe the condensation in a different way, which is not the mean field approximation that people usually do, but which is basically using two-point correlation function and the so-called natural orbitals, which is a formality introduced by Perls and Osanger in 1954. Basically, what you can do is that you can basically describe the fact that you have a condensation looking at correlation functions. And you can describe using correlation function operators, which are ladder operators, which are creating and destroying atoms, not just excited atoms, but also atoms which are part of the condensate. This is the crucial point. So what you can do is that with this formalism, you can basically show that you can reproduce the machinery of analog gravity and keep it into account at the same time what happens to the atoms in the condensate when you have particle creation. This is what we wanted to do. Not only, but you can also introduce some extra ladder operator, which is composed by the ladder operators derived from the natural orbital, which is done in such a way that whenever you take an atom, you put it in an excited state, it has to be taken basically by the condensate and vice versa. This is assured that at each step, you always conserve the number of atoms in your system. Then what you can do is the following. Hawking radiation is very difficult. So what we did was to analyze cosmological particle creation, which as usual is a nice proxy and is easier to handle. So we did basically the standard Lenny Parker exercise. You have a cosmological particle creation by an expanding universe for a finite amount of time. And then you look at the particle creation, what basically is the relation between the in and out states. And what you find is that in general, your correlators show an oscillatory part, which is basically telling you that you will always have atoms oscillating between the condensate and the excited part. But in addition, you will have basically a part which is steady, which tells you that if you want to create particles, basically you have to take atoms from the condensate and promote them to excited atoms. The energy at which expenses this is done is basically the one provided by the expansion. The interesting point is that you always generate in this way correlators between atoms in the condensate and the particle, the quasi-particle in this formalism that you are creating. For example, basically in this language, every time you create an Hawking quanta, you don't have just correlation with the Hawking pairs, but this Hawking pairs is correlated with the atoms in the condensate as well, in the whatever is the underlying Hilbert space of your space-time. These correlators are always present. Each time you do Hawking evaporation or particle creation, they are generated, but they are suppressed by 1 over n0, where n0 are the atoms in the condensate in the region where the particle creation happens, which of course in cosmology would be the total atoms of space-time in the universe, so it's a huge number and would make this totally negligible. In the case of the black hole, you expect actually, we show in another paper that this N0 is exactly the atoms in the black hole region, or in the region, let's say, close to the horizon. And if the horizon shrinks, you expect that these correlators are less and less suppressed and are more and more important. So you may have even that they are becoming dominant after the page time, although we didn't demonstrate that. So let me see what basically we found. What we found is that as long as you work keeping into account the atoms in the condensate, basically the atoms of your space-time in this analogy, basically the operator that links the in and out vacuum is a squeezing operator. And a squeezing operator, as you know, is a unitary operator. There cannot be any violation of unitarity. What happens is that nonetheless, this is an operator that exactly is generating this correlation that I just told you about. Now, what happens if you take an in state, for example, which factorizes, which basically is a part which is the mean field atoms in the condensate times the excitation. In general, after you have this particle creation, you see in this formal that it doesn't factorize anymore. You have generated these correlators. Now, what normally we do is that we neglect that there is an Hilbert space associated to spacetime. We take these operators, we replace them with C numbers, and then these correlators disappear. Does it bring an information loss per se, this operation? No, this is not equivalent to trace. It's basically neglecting this, it's replacing a quantum object with a classical one. And in principle, it's fine. If you basically look, you do this, our squeezing operator becomes the standard squeezing operator relating locking pairs, basically the relating the in and out vacuum in the Uru state. However, now you have the problem that when you have a black hole, you have a singularity. So at some point you cannot trace the locking partner anymore. You have to basically trace over them because your semi-classical description breaks down. And then what you do? You trace over the locking partner and then your operator, your evolution is no more unitary. So what is the lessons basically here? And I want to say one simple thing. We analyze then the back reaction of Hawking radiation by inserting basically the contribution of the quasi-particle created in the first equation that you saw, the one describing the evolution of the mean field, in the case of a class of acoustic black hole, and we found that they actually shrink, like in the standard case, even if the equation is not the Einstein equation. And I wonder if this is a general behavior or not. It's something that is open for investigation. But anyway, the lesson is what it is. It's basically that what is happening from the point of view of analog gravity when you have Hawking evaporation. The answer is that as long as you work on the full Hilbert space, there is no unitary violation, of course. Now, in some situation, you can even start factorizing the gravity Hilbert space and the matter Hilbert space, but in general, Hawking evaporation or cosmological particle production do not preserve this factorization. If you insist that the space-time is purely classical because you want to do some classical gravity, you replace the quantum operators associated to the quantum space-time with the expectation value on a coherent state, and then you have a classical object, then these correlators are no more traceable for you, and still the situation would look unitary as long as you can basically take into account the other quasi-particle member. But when you have a singularity and you need to trace, you basically lose the information. If you keep everything at the description of the full Hilbert space, the information is never lost. So the answer would be that if you have the complete evaporation of a black hole, whatever is the mechanism or the way, maybe a transition between a black hole and a white hole and so on, still you will not have any unitary violation. What you will have is that if your final state is Minkowski with radiation, this will be an entangled state between the quantum degrees of freedom in space-time and the object that you call matter over this space-time. They cannot disentangle. This, I think, is a general lesson. As long as there is a unique Hilbert space at the fundamental level, of course, if you have a quantum gravity model in which matter is completely disentangled from, I mean, doesn't speak to gravity at the quantum level, they are completely separate Hilbert space, then you may try to evade this solution, but then I will tell you how is possible that the coupling between gravity and matter saves it. So from this point of view, from the analog gravity point of view, the information loss problem is a semi-classical gravity artifact. It's not something that pertains to quantum gravity. Okay, so final lesson.
So may I ask?
The final lesson has to do with the cosmological constant. And it is basically related to-
Sorry, Stefano. I think there is a question by Sansi.
Yeah. Hi, may I ask a question?
Yes, sorry, I didn't see, I couldn't see the screen.
Yeah, sorry. So imagine that you have a very large initial black hole. And in your scenario, is it correct to say that you expect that the semi-classical approximation to break down well before this black hole shrink to some microscopic size?
I would say that my conjecture is that it will break down. I mean, you have these correlators are always present. Every time you have Hawking radiation, then you generate this correlator with the substratum. So from this point of view, they are never non-present. They are always on. Simply, they are negligible at the start for a relatively large black hole because they are suppressing one over N0, where N0 is the number of the atoms in the black hole region. Okay, so a large black hole will have this correlator, but they will be extremely negligible. So you will be very well close to the standard open picture. So where you can neglect basically the quantum nature of space time. My impression is, however, is that they grow, I mean, my impression, you see that they grow in importance as the black hole shrinks. But they don't need, the black hole doesn't need to become Planckian, if this was your question, for this to become non-negligible. Non-negligible doesn't mean that they are dominant, right? So non-negligible means that I have the suspicion, but I mean, now a calculation doesn't prove it, to be fair, that basically there is something going on like the page time, that basically if you know that the information is preserved and you know that it's perfectly well-defined to talk, for example, about entanglement entropy in this acoustic black hole. You have entanglement entropy. It's even naturally cut off for you because the horizon is thick. So I think that with this, given that you have to resolve, you know that unitarity is not lost, and given that you know these correlators, and given that you know that you need to basically restore to have this correlator to become important in a macroscopic time, I would say that probably there should be something like a page curve in the game. But that is my conjecture and I haven't proved it.
Okay, thank you, yeah.
So let me go back now to the third and last lesson, which is the cosmological constant. I think that I don't need to preach to the converted in the sense that you know very well what is the plan, the problem with the cosmological constant. Normally, the statement of the problem is that if you look at the vacuum energy, this appears to be, even if you cut off at the Planck scale, the energy density appears to be huge. So the problem is that if you do the same in analog gravity, it looks like you have the same problem. If I cut off the energy associated to the phonons, by using the microscopic natural scale that, for example, is associated to Lorentz breaking, which is the one that provides for you a natural cutoff, that would be the Healy length. And it's still a small wavelength such that this energy would be huge. Nonetheless, it's clear that this is not the energy that is back reacting on the condensate. So the question is, can we understand a bit better what's going on in this case? So let me go back to the basic equation, the equation for the background for the condensate. This is what would be the Gross-Pitaisky equation if I neglect this back reaction of the excited atoms. But let's take now the contribution of the excited atoms. Could this be, for example, a kind of gravitational equation? Because all in all, psi for me is the classical wave function of the condensate. It encodes basically the density and the velocity of the condensate. And then it should be basically associated to the classical space time. By the way, this is an old paper that we did with Florian. So I like to say to explain it to Florian again in the presence of Florian. So the point is that this is clearly a non-relativistic equation. So you cannot for sure mimic Einstein gravity. At most, what you can say, you can ask yourself, can this be a kind of Poisson equation? And the answer is surprisingly yes. Let's see how. First of all, normally the phonons are massless. So if you want to mimic something which is Newtonian gravity, you would like to work with a massive body. But you can do get a massive phonon by adding a soft U1 breaking term that basically transforms a Gunston boson in a pseudo Gunston boson. So you have a mass. And you can calculate now the dispersion relation of the quasi-particle they have in a mass that is acquired exactly by this lambda factor, which is the soft U1 breaking. Okay, now we have massive quasi-particle propagating on this acoustic space-time. We want to see how they decreate on the background through the equation that I shall show you at the start. We want to see basically if we have something like Newtonian gravity. And the answer is yes, how basically you find out that the perturbation in density play the role of the gravitational potential. You can prove exactly what looking at the Hamiltonian for the non-relativistic particles. quasi particle, you look at the analog of the gravitational potential term. So you identify what is the analog of the gravitational potential in this system. And then what you do is that you put it back in the fundamental equation and you say, imagine I have a set of phonons, real phonons in this space-time, and then in addition, I have a vacuum fluctuation. So my anomalous mass and density are split in a real phonon contribution and a vacuum contribution. Then you basically rewrite this in terms of the potential. I just show you, you find a modified Poisson equation. This is basically is a Poisson equation for a short range gravity. This L is basically the Hilly length. It's telling you that this would be a short range gravitational system. So there is Lorentz violation again, if you like. So it's, but this is a Poisson equation. It has the right, you know, 4 pi gn rho term plus a cosmological constant, which is coming from this vacuum contribution, which is the depletion, basically the fact that there is no such a thing as a perfect condenser. You always have a bunch of atoms in the excited state, even if you don't have real phonons around. And so what is telling you? That you have an emerging Newton constant, an emerging cosmological constant, and you can even compare them, and you find that the cosmological constant has an energy which is way smaller than the Planck energy, that emergent Planck energy. Basically by rho zero a cube, which is the dilution parameter I told you about at the start. This has to be much smaller than one, otherwise the whole setup that we described is not okay from the first step because you have a multi-atom interaction to keep it account. So what is the lesson here? That in general, the cosmological constant in this emergent space-time is not something that you can calculate with effective field theory from the emergent quasi-particle, from the physics of the matter and the Kerr space-time. What you have to do is that you have to emerge the dynamical equation, the analog of the Einstein equation, and see what gravitates there. And what it gravitates, lambda, is really related to the depletion factor, not, for example, the free energy or the canonical energy density of the atoms in the condensate. It's really the depletion factor, is the amount of atoms which are in the excited state, even in vacuum, even when you have no Fourier phonons. So it's basically telling you that if you emerge your space-time by a sort of condensation mechanism, you inevitably have this constant in the game. Now you may ask, can you go relativistic? And the answer is again, yes. You can take a relativistic Bose-Einstein condensate, it's a sort of lambda phi to the fourth to the complex stellar field. And in this case, as I was telling you, the metric, the acoustic geometry take this formal form. But what you can do is that, and normally here is already very interesting because you have a system where at low energy you have a gravity, basically curved geometry and phonons and acoustic, local acoustic Lorentz invariants. Then what you do is that you have a transition region where you have a rainbow geometry, momentum dependent geometry, and then at high energy you have relativistic atoms in Minkowski. So you have no more gravity and your quasi particle transmutated in relativistic atoms, so you have the standard Lorentz group. So this is a case where you have Lorentz invariants in the infrared and the UV, and then you have just a transition regime in the middle. Now, you can fine tune this system in such a way that basically you have the speed of sound is equal to the speed of light. In that case, this is it's not something you can do in a lab, but you can do theoretically. In that case, what you get is a system where you have the acoustic geometry is conformally flat, and you can show that this conformal factor enters basically in the geometry with this equation for the excitation, but the background equation for this system, exactly the analog of the one I show you in the non-relativistic case, takes a striking form because it takes the form of the Einstein-Fokker equation. So you find the prototype 1913, the ancestor of general relativity, you find non-strong gravity, which is the only other theory in four dimensions that satisfies the strong equivalence principle, with a cosmological constant that in this case is present in a certain sense at the three levels, even before you take into account depletion, and is positive in this case. In the other case, the depletion provides for you a negative cosmological constant, while here you have a positive cosmological constant. You see, it's related to this lambda factor that here is the lambda phi to the four. You can have a depletion as a correction to this and will be negative and will subtract, will make this cosmological constant smaller than the three-level result. So Also here, the energy density in the cosmological constant will be small with the energy density with respect to the energy density of the emergent Planck's constant. And the interesting point is that you get so close to general relativity. Nonetheless, you don't get general relativity, and you can't get general relativity because here you have only a scalar degrees of freedom. So at most, you can get scalar gravity. And secondly, you have a background structure, which is Minkowski causal structure. And in a certain sense, this is telling you that the background dependency here is what is going to kill you always when you do real analog gravity. So what next? Well, you see, the problem is that in a certain sense, you have an issue of, is it possible in a setting of ideas similar to analog gravity to get background independence? The answer is can be possibly found in a theorem enunciated by Marrow in 2015, where it basically showed that if you want emergence of analog gravity, but at the same time you want background independence, it looks like you have to pay this with a kinematical non-locality. Basically, the notion of locality between the emergent system and the fundamental system must be radically different. In Bose-Einstein condensate, it's not the case because basically the canonical commutation relation of the emergent quasi-particle are inherited from the fundamental fields. So it looks like non-locality could be a crucial ingredient if you want to pursue this route. And let me add the comment. It looks like it is also a crucial ingredient because if you don't want to have a Lorentz violation in the UV, it looks like you need to have non-locality as well. An example of this is, for example, if take causal set, where by construction, basically, you have the sprinkle is done in such a way to be Lorentz invariant. If you look at the emergent Klein-Gordon equation, you don't get a box phi equals zero, but you get f of box phi equals zero. You need to have non-locality to have a well-defined emergent propagator, let's say, D'Alembertian operator. Otherwise, the fluctuation is too low and too large. So that is a very interesting point, and it seems to suggest that the non-locality could be a key to do two things in one time, possibly, in the best scenario. Remove Lorentz violation in the UV, and at the same time, possibly lead to the possibility of an emergence which doesn't use a kind of background structure, and so doesn't fully restore the ground independence. But this is, I must admit, is very speculative, and so I will close here. So we saw basically three lessons. The three lessons are that okay, radiation is robust with respect to UV correction, and you don't, even if you don't like Lorentz violation, basically I think is providing a very good example in a comparable setting of how basically you get the robustness. I have only one comment here. There is a lot of interesting stuff that is coming out about the black hole thermodynamics in aurora gravity that I think is worth at some point to discuss, because there is an amazing resilience of the cold thermodynamics even to UV Lorentz violation. And this amazing resilience, however, is really rooted in how you restore the ground independence. So it's a long story, but I want to say just this. Analog gravity, in this respect, it teaches a lesson, but when you go to gravitational theory with Lorentz violation, is even more complicated and interesting, the lessons that you can draw. But let me close here because it will be a long discussion. Lesson two, the information loss problem. Of course, in a system like this, information cannot be lost, but the way it's not lost is interesting. It's telling you that in a Hawking evaporation, you have an information loss problem if and only if you forget that there is an inverse space associated to gravity, and that this entanglement between gravitational degrees of freedom and Hawking radiation is present all the way. Third, the cosmological constant. The cosmological constant seems also to be an artifact, the problem at least, of applying a bit too naively effective theory on curved space-time, because it shows you that in system where you are emerging your space-time, in a certain sense, you have really to look at the way you recover your field equation, and only then you understand what gravitates. It's not so obvious what gravitates in an emergent space-time scenario. And in the Bose-Einstein condensate, you find that the answer is quite interesting about what is providing the cosmological constant. So many other things, I think, in this analog gravity 2.0 can be addressed. For example, this notion of non-locality could be interesting. If quantum mechanics really applies at the fundamental level, what is local at the fundamental level? It might be not local at the emergent level. So it may be that understanding within this framework phenomena like EPR could be interesting. And that's just an example of where other, again, this analogy might at least shape our idea, albeit it's not going to solve anything for us, because for that we need a definitive theory of quantum gravity. So anyway, I think that the lessons that there are still things that we can teach, and we can use this tool in a useful way. And I think that what Kepler used to say is probably still true. So I wish to thank you for the attention.
Thanks, Stefano, for the very interesting talk. Let's thank Stefano. Are there questions? First from students.
Hi, yeah, I have a question. First, thanks. That was a really nice talk and a good introduction to analog gravity. So first, you were talking a lot about Hawking radiation and sort of mostly in Bose-Einstein systems, but in other ones. But can you say much about like the scale at which back reaction becomes important in these systems? And does that tell you much about similar effects in gravitational systems?
The scale at which back reaction becomes important, the back reaction of Hawking radiation, you mean?
Yes, exactly.
Well, we had this calculation regarding back reaction of Hawking radiation, what is called a canonical acoustic black hole, which is the simplest acoustic black hole you can do.
Yeah.
We find out that there is at each step always a back reaction, but of course it increases with the as the black hole shrinks. I mean, the interesting point is that for some mysterious point, I mean, I don't know, I'm still baffled by this, because you know, the equation, the background equation of the acoustic space-time are not the acoustic equation. Nonetheless, you find these strange things that the black hole still shrinks, mm-hmm. and it generates. I think it's related to the fact that we were still imposing a number conserving formalism. It's a kind of conservation of energy, but in the broader sense of the system, right? So it may be that this is the key point. And the back reaction is always there, but there isn't a critical scale at which that becomes important, because you have to define when it becomes important. It's always at the first step of the shrink. But of course, the energy you release in Hawking radiation, it has to do basically with the temperature. So the power emitted, if you like, you know? So the hotter it becomes, the system, the higher is going to be the back reaction in a certain sense, if you believe in a kind of, so there isn't an answer which is very different from the standard case, from the analog gravity. I don't think that there is there, for example, the fact that there is a microscopic scale is so fundamental, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Lee, I see you have raised your hand.
Yes, I'd like to make a suggestion that you don't talk anymore about analog gravity. What you're talking about is a system of models for quantum space-time, which are fundamentally discrete, and which are fundamentally don't have a notion of locality, because they don't exist in space-time. But there do exist in your models, in each of them, a notion of energy and a notion of momentum. So you're pursuing a hypothesis, which is that the fundamental theory of gravity is a theory where there is something like quantum causation, and there is also conservation of energy and conservation of momentum.
Yeah, the nice point, Lee, is that all of this is inspired by a real system.
Yeah, all the better, all the better.
And I want to just tell you that, for example, you can do, it's feasible, I mean, it's feasible, it's conceivable that in a few years, you can even do an experiment to see these correlators, for example, to test the presence of this correlator. That would be really nice. But I agree with you. At this point, this analog gravity 2.0, how much is analog gravity and how much is a kind of modelization, a scenario for quantum gravity? Maybe you're right that in a sense is becoming something into this. There is another branch which is experimental analog gravity that is now moving on its own. No?
Right. But I do think that analog gravity is too modest. And there is a collection of quantum space-time models, and you're investigating how we take coarse graining approximations and describe the bulk thing.
Exactly. My main interest, Lee, I think you really captured what, for me, the, my main interest is understanding how the coarse grading in quantum gravity works. And, you know, for someone that is coming from quantum gravity phenomenology, this is not a secondary question. Sure. I understand, I mean, I got the impression sometimes that in the quantum gravity community, it's not such a pressing question sometimes, because people is more, is still dealing with the, you know, having the theory being self-consistent, having everything in place. But in a certain sense, the way the, you know, the classical and you know, the and continuous limit, which do not need to be the same, by the way. Sure. I think for me, that the interest in quantum gravity phenomenology has become a pressing question. For example, you see, there is one point. For example, what is a gravitational wave in quantum gravity?
Sure.
If you do, for example, space-time thermodynamics a la Jacobson, you don't see gravitational fluxes because you cannot put a conserved stress energy tensor on the right-hand side. But you see an Hartley-Hawking tight dilating. You see a much deeper right. When you go beyond the equilibrium. And you see, and I don't know, probably you do remember this because I remember you had some paper in this direction. You remember that there is a paper by Candelas and Shama regarding the reversible thermodynamics.
Candelas and Shama, sure.
Yeah, and you also work in this direction which I try to remember the date of your paper, but it's probably early 2000, something like that. You had a paper in this direction. The Hartley-Hawking tight dilating. To me, for example, a gravitational wave is not an excitation on the space-time. It's in the space-time. I mean, I would like to understand if it can be described a gravitational waves, for example, in a spin network as something that is a complexity of the spin network varying along the when you have a gravitational wave, basically that would be the excitation of internal degrees of freedom of space-time. It would be more similar to any.
Let me just respond by saying that I think what we're both interested in is skipping a step, because the step is not really the next step. Is the derivation from some classical world of its quote quantization. When you want to go directly from the model to the phenomenology, you I think what you should be saying is you're going directly from the theory to the phenomenology. Your models are candidate theories. And I think that if you just use different words, you would see them that way. And what you call phenomenology is just what everybody calls deriving the observable consequences.
No, I agree with that. I mean, they are candidate models because you still don't have under control, but you have scenario that you can test. And then if you find severe constraint, you can.
I think if you were so inclined, you could invent principles to make them look fancier. Because I think the only difference between those and those that have principles embedded in their justification or taste.
Anyway. I don't know, you have to do it probably with the, I'm not sure I'm getting your point, but I agree with you that this kind of exercise has to be done with the real care and looking at what, you know, quantum gravity is really, for what we understand, telling you.
Well, it would be good to talk sometime. Thank you very
much. Yeah, great, I mean, yes. Every time we talk, we end up saying it would be nice to talk. Yes, Lauren.
Hello, Stefano. Thank you for your very nice talk and review. I just want you to expand a little bit on the last point you're making about non-locality being necessary for kind of the equivalence principle. Can you just say what type of non-locality? Because non-locality is so vague.
Yeah, no, there is a very good point. Exactly. I think that this is a very good point, because Marolf, for the emergence of analog gravity, is basically suggesting that if you want to have a dynamical degrees of freedom in the bulk, basically you need to have a different notion of microcausality to be more correct. But there is also the issue. So really, microcausality in the sense of commutator of emergent fields and fundamental fields that commutate with a different notion of what is the causal structure. That is the minimal requirement. But what I'm trying to say is that, for example, if you try to insert a fundamental length scale in your problem and you don't want to introduce Lorentz violation, it's very difficult in a sense, I don't know how to say. For example, in causal set, you really see that you want to have a generalization of locality in the sense of non-local effective theory, infinite series of derivatives. You have the function of a box. The box is the Lorentz invariant operator, right? But the generalization of the Kingordon you get is that it's a where f is a non-analytic function. In string field theory, you get a function of the box, where it's an exponential, it's an analytic function. And then you can, so that kind of non-locality, of course, allows you to insert this length scale there without doing anything to your propagator is still Lorentz invariant. So, however, the non-locality, for example, in causal sets, it's necessary to suppress fluctuation when you do the continuous limit. I mean, your discrete operator, what you call the operator that describes the propagation of the field from one side to the other in your causal set, basically gets in the continuous limit, it would fluctuate too much if you don't put this non-locality scale. So I'm just saying that, I don't know, non-locality seems to pop up as an alternative in this emergent scenario, and they may be doing the two things at the same time. And data is very common. I mean, I think I didn't stress that enough in the two papers that in these two direction that they quoted, that they apparently you're not talking about the same notion of non-locality. You know as well that there is a branch of research in doing a generalization of the Einstein field equation with non-local operators, right? Now as well. So there they say that you can solve some of the issues that you have in higher curvature gravity because you don't get ghost, because basically when you have this kind of infinite series of derivatives, you don't have the stochastic theorem. The stochastic theorem is valid only if you truncate the series. So that's the basic idea. So you may do the two things, having this fundamental scale in the problem that describe maybe a anisotropic regime, which may be also momentum dependent as is suggested by the Sanal gravity model, and then at the same time not having an hardcore Lorentz violation.
Mm-hmm. My question was also, how would you do that in a analog model? So I understand that the theory space level what you're saying, but what do you mean by you know, then don't you lose the power of the analogy? Because
because I don't know, or I haven't clear or I haven't clarified in my mind yet how to build a mechanism where it's clearly it's not going to be an analog gravity system in the traditional sense of the word. It's not going to be something you can realize in a lab. But what you want to have at the zero level, if you follow the Marolf intuition, is that you want to build up a theorem, a system where the fundamental atoms maybe have some microcausality, but you need to have a mechanism that at the emergent level embodies a different microcausality. Now, in a sense, what you want is that the speed of sounds appear in ruling the microcausality of the emergent system. But normally what you have is you have emergent quantum operators, which are excitation over the background, but they inherit the same commutation relation. Only after you have the quasi-particle as a notion of causality to the speed of sound. So it's not so clear to me. And it's basically where I think this approach to emergent space-time is a bit stuck at the moment, because it requires basically to have a breakthrough in this direction. But I don't know, basically, otherwise I would have done. It may be that it's not, one has really to abandon this kind of condensed matter driven intuition and go for something radically different. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so maybe an extra question on that. Because in the quantum Hall effect, there is something like that. The locality of the quasi-particle has nothing to do with the locality of the sample. So, but that's not these things you're talking about. So that's the only example I know where somehow, you know, the emergent locality is completely different from from.
Yeah, but you need that you have also a system that emerges an effective space time for the emergent particles. You see, then you have to do the two things at the same time.
Yeah, that second part I know. That goes back to the question of Lee of equivalence principle in some sense.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I mean, maybe just a remark about, you know, what you're saying about black hole radiation and this emergent model and this entanglement. I think this is exactly where just people are understanding now that the source of the paradox is just kind of a wrong hypothesis that the black hole radiation can be done independently of the Hilbert space of gravity. And that can be done even at the semi-classical level. So I think, you know, this
yeah, but I think that, I don't know. Okay, maybe I'm biased here, but I feel that this is well accepted in a community which is not the whole community working on the information loss problem, because very often you still see people insisting in solving the information loss problem basically just in semi-classical gravity. And basically, if this intuition is correct, it's completely wrong, and you will never get the resolution there. But I'm just stressing that, as you know better than me, there is a part of the community working on this issue that seems not very, you know, prone to accept this kind of fact that you have to, you cannot neglect that there is an inverse space for gravity.
And
you cannot assume that it's always factorized with matter, that the two sectors do not speak.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I don't know. There's a disconnect between people who know quantum gravity and know what you're talking about and people that work on the information paradox, assuming something which is blatantly wrong. And yeah, I don't know how to reconcile that. I mean, you can tell them, but yeah, they don't really listen. If you have a way to do it, great.
Well, I think I'm making this talk also to advertise that, I mean, this is a simple system where you clearly see, you know, that and of course, you can say the two sectors do not speak, they are separated forever. There is the Hilbert space of gravity, you can always disconnect. But I don't see how, I mean, in gravitational theory, how you can say you change the representation of what is matter is gravity and gravity is matter. I mean, there isn't, already that at the classical level, you see that disentangling gravity and matter is basically impossible. So I don't really, I just want to say that I totally agree with you, and it seems that maybe to a subset of the community working on this issue kind of stating the obvious, but as you know, there are many papers that are trying to solve the information loss problem in a purely semi-classical paradigm.
I think we can't solve everybody else's problems. We have an absolute to solve the real physics. No, seriously, I think after 30 something years of telling people, for example, that that diagram that Stephen wrote down is wrong, there's so much to say.
Yeah, exactly. No, because you know that quantum gravity, if you ask yourself, you have to resolve the singularity, you immediately see that the diagram, there are a finite way of solving the singularity, first of all, and none of them is compatible with the diagram.
Right, well, that's the point. If you believe that diagram, you believe the problem is at the horizon, that mysterious point that doesn't exist where they meet. If you question that diagram, you bring the center of attention to the singularity, which is where the real problem is.
I agree. But the singularity, so is what you can also say that it's telling you, you have to take into account the hyperspace of gravity here. You cannot just forget about it. Because a singularity is a region where you know that the inverse space, the gravitational degrees of freedom are not anymore something that you can simply forget about. So sure. There is not going to be a singularity, but there is going to be a regime where the inverse space of gravity cannot be neglected as usual.
Sure.
And so it sounds off.
Say the theory is strongly coupled at the singularity, whereas you approach the singularity.
Exactly, and those correlators will stay. If you're at the end, you don't have any more the black hole, that correlators will be there forever. And you cannot, if you want to restore the unitarity of the state, the, the purity of the state, for example, of the initial state, you have to take them into account. You cannot throw them away. Right. It may be basically impossible in a practical way, but that doesn't imply that there is information lost at all.
Right. Now, some of the younger people should be asking questions that indicate that they understand the problem better than we. Right, that's what the younger people are supposed to do.
Sorry, I cannot hear you anymore. I mean, it's broken a little bit.
No, I was just saying that the more of the younger people should ask questions.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. So, are there other questions? So I don't see other questions, but I would have a couple of questions. One is really about the analogy itself. So I see that assuming that there is an analogy between gravitational systems and condensed matter systems, there is really a lot that one can learn. But how do I know when on which regime the analogy breaks down and then the deviations that I'm seeing do not come from a deviation from what we know, but rather from a breakdown of the analogy?
This is a good point, but in fact, normally you don't use the analogy this way. You use the analogy to understand think about the radiation. You use the analogy to understand the robustness. If we would have found that, for example, the answer to the survival of Hawking radiation would have depended on the detail of the UV Lorentz breaking, then it would have been basically something that was relying on the particular feature of the analogy. Normally, what you do instead, the answer is that it doesn't depend on the UV completion, as long as you have a separation of scale. While if for the other cases that I show you, it's not relying on the detail of how the analog gravity system works. It's relating, if you like, on the fact that there is a unique Hilbert space at the bottom of everything. There is a unique Hilbert space. You assume that number conservation is basically a way to say that there isn't any degrees of freedom that escape to another universe. And then these together basically brings you the answer. So the answer is general and doesn't rely on the detailed structure of the equation. In the case of the cosmological constant, yes, it relies on the detailed structure of the equation, but the lessons that you draw is again general, because it's telling you that when the way from quantum gravity you produce space-time is a way where you don't just remove a regulator, a discrete regulator, but you really have that your substratum, say, is something on which you have to take, for example, an expectation value in a highly populated coherent state, and then you look at the excitation of every state and so on. Then in this case, again, what is going to be gravitating and giving you the cosmological constant is something general, because it's basically the part which is excited above the operation, which remains above the operation of generating this classical continuous space-time from this quantum and discrete structure. So I think the short answer to your question is that you never put yourself in the situation in which you have to decide if you have a feature that is relying everything on the detail of your system, is suspicious. It may be just an artifact of the analog gravity system. You can only draw this kind of general lesson or lessons that are not relying on the UV. But again, in a sense, you see, the point is that if you can use the analog system in a way that is really portraying for you a scenario of how space-time emerges from a substrate in a general way from a discrete and quantum substructure. That's the point.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this matters or not, but in some points of your presentation, there were, in a sense, assumptions on what would be the basic UV structure. So for instance, a possible violation of Lorentz invariance, or in the model that you have shown, I think it was based on Florian's paper, the fact that you can write down that equation where you have a clear distinction between a kinetic part and the potential part that may be in gravity will not be the case, especially in a non-local model such as those that you were mentioning.
No, you're right that there are parts in this derivation where really you are using the feature that you are allowed to use because you are an ecosystem and you are simplification because you are still living in a container. You have the scaffolding of Minkowski around you, which is also the price to pay in the fact that you will never get in this way, in this trivial way that I show you really the Einstein field, the way you will never get something the ground independence. The issue is that if using the same kind of idea, there is any chance to get the ground independence, and that is where no locality will come, may come into the game. So I agree with you. It's not that using this sense, but I do think that the lessons that I've discussed today do not rely on those steps. At the end of the day, you gather a general lesson, which is in a sense strong. For example, the fact that if you are in a setting where you need to emerge space-time, and in a certain sense, the gravitons are not fundamental particle, maybe a collective excitation or excitation of the inner degrees of freedom of your sort of underlying quantum discrete structure, then in a certain sense, I think there is a general lesson that you cannot worry about the vacuum energy before you understand what ends up gravitating in your emergent you know, field equation. That's the point, because the field equation will be the equation, what you call the Einstein equation, are the equation for an emergent quantity. So you have to understand what is going to gravitate there. So the lesson, I still think that as a general balance, or at least I hope to, and for this reason, I think it's worth investigating.
Yeah, I agree that it is worth investigating that and. I also agree that the general lessons we have presented are generally just trying to understand to which extent one can use it also in like to learn to have some predictions or more than predictions, like inputs of something that one can investigate in quantum gravity. But yeah, so.
And they can guide you, for example, in setting up some kind of calculation quantum gravity rather than the other. No? You may have the intuition from here in which direction you may explore, but you have to use ground solids. I mean, analogies are excellent and inspiring, but they may be false friends because they, if you, on a case-by-case basis, you have to ask yourself if they are not fooling you. No? I think that the one has, doesn't have to be over enthusiastic, but in some cases I think they might. I mean, for me, for example, they are inspired to trying to understand better some features in quantum gravity that otherwise I may have overlooked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, makes sense. We are running a little bit out of time, but let me ask just one very short clarification question. So when you were talking about non-locality as an alternative to Lorentz violation, were you referring to a fundamental breakdown of locality, like in non-local gravity, the proper non-local gravity community, or non-locality that can come out of integrating out quantum fluctuations, because that is like the logs that one would see at the level of the effective action, because that would also bring to non-localities in the field equations in the same way non-local gravity would do. But in that case, it's not obvious that you break locality at the fundamental level.
I had in mind exactly the non-locality in the sense of a modification of the Klingorton in FL versus a box, because that is the kind of non-locality that, for example, comes out in causal set and in string field theory. And it can be tested. You know, a very, very interesting point is that you can do an experiment with a quantum oscillator. You put a mirror on a chip, you shine it with a laser, and then you analyze the evolution of the center of mass. And what you can show is that this will evolve with a modified Schrödinger operator. And in general, if this non-locality will basically in the Wigner function, you will have a kind of periodic squeezing that cannot be mimicked by environment. And that is interesting because it could provide the experiment that could be done in principle in the next coming year, and it could give you a constraint on this kind of non-locality, which is better than the one that at CERN. So this is also a kind of non-locality that you can test in a lab with a very high precision. And that is what I remind, because this is exactly what you can get basically very naturally in different approaches, which are built in Lorentz invariants. Okay? You can analyze the propagator, you really see that you have only massless modes. I mean, there is a long story also that can be discussed, but basically it's a very interesting branch of research as well.
Yes, I agree. But I would say that the evaluation of locality in the string field theory and causal sets is different in the sense that in string field theory, it would emerge because of the structure of string theory. So because of the essentially of the infinite tower of massive modes that once you integrate it out, you get no localities out of that, even in the quantum field theory limit of the theory. While in the case of causal sets, for instance, we have a fundamental breakdown of locality. And in that case, you also have that at the level of the field equations. But I don't know, I'm not sure if you can test the fundamental breakdown of locality, since what one looks at is essentially the dressed theory, never the Bayer theory.
Exactly, but let me make a comment. If you take f of box equal of phi equals zero coming with the function coming from string field theory is an exponent, is analytic. The one from causal set is non-analytic, you have box, logarithm of box. So, but also there, if you analyze the propagator, you have an infinite tower of massive modes only on the internal lines. So, and in fact, that non-analytic f of box violates the strong Huygens principle. You have a little tail. You have a little tail in the propagator, which is in four dimension, not just supported on the light on the propagator of a massless scalar field. So effectively, it reproduces the same feature of that you had the tower massive mode that are the origin of the string field theory results. So I don't know if once you are in that limit, you are in classical space-time continuous limit, and you just have the modification of the dynamics of the scalar field, if you can really distinguish where you're coming from. The only difference between the two approaches is that in one case F is analytic, in the other it isn't. But I don't know if that is fundamental because we just have two cases.
Yes, I agree. Okay. It would be nice if you could send the reference for this particular experiment that could distinguish between the two. And said so, I think
when the experiment I talked about it was for string field theory, mm-hmm. was only for string field theory because you have to do an expansion and you need an mm-hmm. analytic function.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I would send you reference of the experiment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks a lot. So I think we have tortured you enough for today. So thanks a lot for the very interesting talk and for the discussion. Hope to see you soon. So thanks, Stefan.
Thank you for inviting me.